Israel's reaction to more war crimes accusations.
Well, it's generally rejected because the Israeli public and many Israeli politicians from across the political spectrum accuse the UN of an extreme bias against Israel.
Plus, Ukraine attacks oil facilities inside Russia.
Ukrainian troops launched a drone attack on Russian oil refineries, Russian radar stations, and electronic intelligence centers in the Bryansk region and in temporary occupied Crimea.
And later, will South Korea supply weapons to Kyiv? And a look at how AI is infiltrating politics and everyday life. Today is Friday, June 21st, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel reacts to the latest round of war crime accusations from the UN, and not surprisingly, they disagree. Profoundly. And Benjamin Netanyahu angers the Biden administration, saying the U.S. withholding arms from Israel is inconceivable. I'm joined by VOA's Ricky Rosen in Tel Aviv.
From what I've seen, this has been a very challenging week for Netanyahu. Facing down demands from the far right members of his coalition, as well as the religious ultra-Orthodox members of his coalition. It seems like he is being backed into a corner, and in order perhaps to prove that he is strong and independent and is going to continue to pursue his war aims of total victory against Hamas, despite any objections that were voiced by the U.S. and European allies, that he was going to go ahead with an aggressive policy. So maybe he was trying to prove to the far right that he is not being cowed by any other considerations.
And last topic I want to breach with you today is something we reported on this show yesterday, and that's another accusation coming from the UN or another international body accusing the Israelis of war crimes in their prosecution of the war in Gaza. It's not the first time this has happened since the war started. What's the reaction inside Israel to this continued international criticism?
Well, it's generally rejected because the Israeli public and many Israeli politicians from across the political spectrum accuse the UN of an extreme bias against Israel, and so they don't take these reports seriously. There were two charges in this particular commission of inquiry which infuriated some of the Israeli political leaders, especially those dealing with the UN. One was that it accused Israel of sexual violence in its treatment of Palestinian prisoners, both in the West Bank and Gaza. And the reason this infuriated Israelis is because the whole issue of sexual violence that was perpetrated by Hamas on October 7th and continues to be alleged to be being perpetrated against female hostages being held still in Gaza. And these charges were not addressed and taken seriously for many, many months by international bodies. And now this Commission of Inquiry report claims that because Israel held men and boys as prisoners and forced them to strip naked, which Israel says was being done in order to make sure that they would not be hiding any kind of explosives under their clothes. And so people object to this equating of of so-called acts of sexual violence being perpetrated by the Israeli army and acts of sexual violence being perpetrated by Hamas. And the other charge, which was deemed to be ridiculous, was that the report condemned the Israeli army for not taking better care of their own civilians on October 7th, protecting them from the Hamas invasion and assault. And so Israelis have said that the UN has not truly addressed the fact that Hamas uses its own civilians as human shields. And so to criticize the very tragic Israeli lack of support and defense of its own civilians is seen as hypocritical at best.
Certainly a lot to unpack there, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for today. VOA's Ricky Rosen is in Tel Aviv. Ricky, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Ukraine and Moldova will start negotiations to enter the EU on June 25th. Meanwhile, the U.S. is now allowing Ukraine to use its weapons on a wider range of Russian territory. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Ukraine's bid to join the EU is moving forward. The EU Council officially confirmed the start of accession negotiations with Ukraine and Moldova will begin on June 25th. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian General Staff reported that in the early hours of Friday, Ukrainian troops launched a drone attack on Russian oil refineries, Russian radar stations and electronic intelligence centers in the Bryansk region and in temporary occupied Crimea. In addition, the armed forces of Ukraine and the security service of Ukraine attacked a fuel and chemistry warehouse in the Russian Tambov region, as well as the Enemska oil depot in the Republic of Adygea. At least five explosions followed by fire were reported there. Also, local residents reported a massive drone attack before dawn on June 21st in the Krasnodar region of Russia. A fire can be seen near the airfield in Yeysk, which Russian forces constantly use for the bombing of Ukrainian territory. Meanwhile, the United States has changed its policy and will now allow Ukraine to use American weapons to hit anywhere on the territory of Russia near the border with Ukraine, from where Russian forces launch attacks and land assaults from their side of the border, not only in the Kharkiv region. This was reported by Politico media outlet referring to the U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Sullivan said in an interview with PBC on Tuesday that the agreement with Ukraine on U.S. weapon strikes against Russia applies to any place where Russian troops cross the border from the Russian side to the Ukrainian side to try seize more Ukrainian territory. In recent days, Russia has said it may soon advance on the northeastern city of Sumy, which is also near the Russian border. The Ukrainian military and top officials previously said that the Sumy region could be Russia's next target. Sullivan said that if that happens, the policy of allowing strikes with provided weapons will apply there as well. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Important news for both European and Asian geopolitics. South Korea says it will consider sending weapons to Ukraine. This after Russia and North Korea signed a new defense pact. VOA's Scott Walterman speaks with Greg Brzezinski. He works on U.S. East Asian relations and East Asian international history at George Washington University.
So let's start with the big picture here. Russia's sort of trying to realign the dynamic in Asia, first in North Korea, in Vietnam, South Korea, then reacts to the pact with North Korea saying, well, maybe we'll send weapons to Ukraine. How unusual is all of this?
I think that it's a somewhat unusual move for South Korea to start intervening in a, you know, in an international conflict by sending weapons. I don't think that's something that South Korea has done very often, if at all, in the previous decades. So I think that the fact that they're willing to even consider doing this now really shows that the pact between Moscow and Pyongyang was perceived as being very threatening by the South Korean leadership.
Well, and you have to assume that North Korea is going to get something for what it's giving Russia beyond. I mean, so, you know, they need food and they need fuel, which Russia has both. But yes, what they really want, I assume, is technology.
Yes, and I think that's South Korea's concern, that that Russia will provide not only food and fuel, but also that it will provide new technologies, that it will help North Korea to further develop its weapons programs, and that it will be difficult to monitor this new partnership between Moscow and Pyongyang and actually see everything that they do.
How much do you think this disrupts Russia-China relations? Because Russia is helping Vietnam take oil out of the China Sea, which China claims is their oil because they claim the South China Sea. It's kind of a dysfunctional, you've got four countries here, right? China, right. North Korea, Vietnam, and Russia, and they don't always align.
That's absolutely true. I think it's a very interesting dynamic, and how China is seeing Putin's recent Asia trip is very interesting and probably conflicted in a number of ways. On the one hand, we've seen that Beijing's relationship with Moscow has actually improved in recent years, in part because there's been rising tensions between Beijing and Washington. And at the same time, Beijing has also been doing some of the same things that Moscow is doing vis-a-vis North Korea. It's also slowly been improving its relationship with North Korea over the last few years. Vietnam is a little bit of a different story because there's territorial disputes between Vietnam and China, and because the Vietnamese, to a much greater degree than they perhaps view Russia as a threat, have seen China as a threat.
Thanks so much for the time.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll take a look at the new world of artificial intelligence in a few minutes. Now to Africa. Russia is increasing its military aid and China is increasing its development on the continent. So what is the U.S. looking for? I spoke with John Shin of Carnegie Mellon University. His latest article appears in the Texas National Security Review.
Well, the United States is trying to do a lot of things in Africa to compete with Russia and China, and to try to promote economic development and security and democracy in the region. You know, there's an outstanding question, of course, about how successful the United States has been and can be in that effort. But part of the problem that American policy faces is, in fact, that there are so many things that the United States is trying to do at the same time. So counterterrorism and violent extremist groups in the Sahel, trying to provide foreign aid in a context in which there's increasing budget constraints on the U.S. foreign aid budget, which then, of course, then makes it harder to compete with investment and economic aid from the likes of China, especially.
But other countries have the same constraints and are faced with the same problems that America is. Are Russia and China just devoting more to Africa? Are they more? Is it a higher priority for them than it is for the U.S.?
Well, I think it's in the case of China, at least, I would say that China has prioritized Africa much more than the United States. China, in fact, has prioritized the global South more than the United States has in general. And of course, over the last two decades, the U.S. has given strategic priority to the Middle East, you know, post 9/11, fighting the so-called forever wars there. And, you know, interestingly, one of the things that we see is that sort of the heart of terrorist insurgency around the world has actually sort of shifted, right, south from the Middle East into North Africa and the Sahel and so on. So I think it would behoove the United States to give greater strategic priority to Africa.
So let's take a step backwards, if we can. What are the U.S.'s goals in Africa? What's President Biden looking for?
Well, Biden's Africa strategy focuses in a number of areas and is quite broad in terms of trying to promote economic development and stability in the region more broadly, to defend democracy in the region, and as well as to promote security interests. I think in practice, one of the things that we notice with Africa policy is that it has become increasingly focused on the threat of terrorism, especially in the Sahel, and with good reason. However, the upshot has been essentially a militarization of Africa policy. In many countries, it is often the Pentagon and defense diplomats out in the lead trying to promote military cooperation and sort of strict kind of military terms, but that the diplomatic engagement on the civilian side and the U.S. putting sort of, you know, dollars on the table to try to actually promote development and help African countries out more broadly has been lacking.
Professor John Chin of Carnegie Mellon University. Professor Chin, thanks so much for your analysis today.
Thank you.
Artificial intelligence is quickly becoming a part of everyday life, and that means it's also part of politics, for better or worse. VOA's Ivana Piedroska looks at the use of AI in the 2024 election in this report narrated for us by Carolyn Prosciutti.
Artificial intelligence has already made an appearance in this election, as in this computer-generated photo of Donald Trump hugging infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci. And this fake robocall of Joe Biden telling New Hampshire voters to skip their primary. Rajul Gupta's firm Deep Media helps the Pentagon detect deepfakes, which he says are popular because they are inexpensive and easy to produce.
End to end, it takes about 15 minutes to create a deepfake. There are many free services online. If you want to pay for some of the better ones, a 30-second audio clip is maybe 2 cents.
Attorney and free speech advocate Ari Cohen.
There's been a lot of talk about Russia, but China also, especially as they are fighting in the AI arms race to try and jump ahead.
Cohen says the most sophisticated overseas operations aim to place a piece of political disinformation with influential Americans for them to pass on to others. The biggest U.S. tech firms and social media platforms have promised some voluntary self-regulation of AI in political campaigns, but no federal laws currently govern the practice. Attorney and free speech advocate Ari Cohen.
It's very, very difficult to regulate political speech in the United States. The First Amendment protects that core political speech very strongly, and for good reason. We don't want the government putting the hands on the its finger on the scale of elections.
Gupta says much of that difficulty lies in distinguishing between something that is false and something that is a characterization of an issue with which one might not agree. Cohen says AI can be used for good in politics. It can allow candidates to reach diaspora communities in their own languages, and it can give campaigns better insight into voter behavior so they can better tailor their messaging. For Ivana Piedroska in Washington, Carolyn Prosciutti, VOA News.
AI and deepfake videos aren't only an issue for American politicians. Reuters' Ilan Rubens introduces us to a young Ukrainian woman whose likeness has been stolen to push propaganda and market products in China.
Around 1 month after I started my YouTube channel, I started receiving messages from people saying that they see me online speaking Mandarin and they think it's not me and someone is stealing my identity.
Ukrainian student Olga Loyak was looking to create an audience on the internet. But not like this. The 21-year-old says her image has been taken and spun through artificial intelligence to create alter egos on Chinese social media platforms. This is just one of Loyak's digital doppelgangers, who appears to be a Russian woman called Natasha. She's fluent in Chinese and wants to thank China for its support of Russia.
I saw that this is literally like my face speaking Mandarin, and on the background, I'm seeing Kremlin and Moscow, and I'm like talking about things like how great Russia and China are, and I'm also like, my clone is advertising different Russian products.
The fake accounts with Loyak's image have hundreds of thousands of followers in China, far more than Loyak herself. They've also sold tens of thousands of dollars in products. Some of the posts even include a disclaimer saying they may have been created using AI. Loyak's face is representative of an increasing number of young Russian women on Chinese social networks. The catch? None of these doppelgangers actually exist. Experts say they are AI-generated, using clips of real women found online, often without their knowledge. The avatars, like Loyak's, express their love of China and say they want to support Russia at war by selling products from their homeland. Experts say the videos using the fake avatars often pitch products to single Chinese men.
If the clone is portrayed as a Russian woman, she would talk about things like, I really want to find a Chinese husband, and I really want to go to China and live there for the rest of my life and have a family there because like this country is so great. So a lot of propagandist motives I was seeing there.
Jim Chai is the CEO of XMOV, a company that develops advanced AI technology, but not involved in Loyak's predicament. He says the technology that creates such deepfakes is very common in China.
For example, to produce my own 2D digital human, I just need to shoot a 30-minute video of myself, and then after finishing that, I rework the video. Of course, it looks very real, and of course, if you change the language, the only thing you have to adjust is the lip sync. Actually, the only technology used here in AIGC is lip sync.
Loyak's story sheds light on the risks of the potentially illegal or unethical applications of artificial intelligence. The use of deepfake technology has intensified concerns about how AI could add to misinformation, fake news, and copyright issues. In January, China issued draft guidelines for standardizing the AI industry, proposing to form more than 50 national and industry-wide standards for AI by 2026.
On Artificial Intelligence Act.
In Europe, the European Union's new AI Act imposes strict transparency obligations on high-risk AI systems. Still, many governments around the world are scrambling to catch up with the pace of AI applications, and some, like Loyak, remain caught up in the middle.
I really do not like the fact that anyone can use anyone else's face to make them say anything you want. And I really don't like that my face can be posed as someone completely different, as someone who would never say these, like I am not the person who would say these things in my life, and I don't want anyone to believe that I would.
That's Alon Rubens of Reuters with that report. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.